I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one, in the Obama moment, is with the global anthropologist John Comaroff, white, South African, a tennis player, an eminent scholar now at the University of Chicago, a neighbor of Barack Obama. He's still a specialist in sub-Saharan Africa and issues of identity, order, boundaries, media, capital of the human, social, and financial kinds all over the late modern world. John Comaroff, such a pleasure. It's so clear in the headlines, in the celebrations, in the videos, the tears, the feeling that we are at a world moment such as perhaps we've never experienced in our lifetimes. In the wider world, can you finger what's going on?
Well, I think we can. I think this is an exciting moment, and I think it is a global moment. After all, this is the first American election, I think, that the entire world responded to, and responded to as though this were at home. And in some ways, it reminds me of the election of Nelson Mandela, not merely because two black men heralded in a return to democracy, a democracy long lost, but also because this was the re-entry of a pariah nation back into the world. Mm. After all, for the last 8 years, America has become steadily a pariah nation, just as South Africa under apartheid became a pariah nation.
Ooh, that's tough. That's
oh, yeah, true. But it's true. Wander around the streets of Soweto or the barrios of Lagos or wherever over the last 8 years, and Bush was a description of the Bush. We used to talk in Cape Town about the scary bourgeoisie in Washington, D.C., and there were songs like that, right? But yes, I think this heralded in a moment at which the world pauses and says something different has happened. Has something different happened? We don't know that yet. History will tell us. But certainly, for the first time in a long time, there's a return of a kind of optimism to America. There is a real sense of a charismatic moment, a Durkheimian moment of collective effervescence in which America looks at itself and feels it can celebrate something, even though, 48 million people voted against Barack Obama. But nonetheless, the process was something that really engaged people in a very different kind of way. I was saying to some friends and colleagues here at Brown University, where my daughter was an undergraduate not that long ago, that in previous times, it was very hard to get Brown students engaged in the electoral process. I actually was here after an election and asked a bunch of students, had they voted? The vast majority said no. Ask today and everybody's voted. My own students in Chicago, everybody was out campaigning in Indiana, even in counties they knew they were going to lose. But being part of the moment was important. And I think that what we have seen is a regeneration of American politics. And I use regeneration in the double sense, a return to an energy, but also a new generation being involved in the political process and being socialized into the sense of democracy. After all, I think we have, over the last 8 years, lost democracy to a Bush administration that really was an Agambinist nightmare, in the sense that everything was treated as though it were emergency, exception. Every time there was an expression of democracy, we were told that the terror level was orange and goodness knows what else, and therefore we had to suspend the ordinary activities of democracy. Mm. Argument. The lifeblood of a nation was basically robbed from us. The Patriot Act took away, for all practical purposes, the Bill of Rights. The fetishism of the signing statement took away the real purpose of the legislative process. After all, if a president could decide that he didn't like what democracy had produced and therefore subvert it, we were back in the worst senses of a kind of Euro monarchy of the 17th and 18th century. This was not democracy. Mm. What precisely it was? It was certainly autocratic. Whether it was technically fascist, an interesting question. We still had elections, but God knows the real expressions of freedom left with us. And I think the Obama moment has forced attention back on what America is. What do we stand for here? You know, I'm originally South African. I lost my citizenship in the apartheid struggle. I became an American citizen, but I felt that for the last 8 years that meant very little. I understood when Michelle Obama said, I feel American for the first time at a crucial moment. And of course, this was taken to be a statement about patriotism. It wasn't a statement about patriotism. It was a statement about citizenship. After all, what we have learned to live with, or what we had to learn to live with over the Bush years, was citizenship by exclusion. After all, many of our public debates were about exclusion. Black Americans felt excluded. Hispanic Americans felt excluded. We had all kinds of very bizarre conversations about immigration, as though we weren't talking about human beings, but purely labor commodities. Even the nature of human disposability became the real problem. And this is a terrible thing for a democracy, that we have we had a hugely disposable population who suddenly feel re-empowered. I like to tell a story about the Obama...
go for it.
May I? We have a cleaner in our building, 70-something-year-old African-American guy, sweet, sweet guy. And every evening about 6, he comes into our office and takes our garbage, etc. Of course, casualized because universities have casualized their labor. Work has changed. We no longer have the world of work that we knew it in under sort of the high modernist capital era. Anyway, he didn't rock up to work on Tuesday. I taught late, so I was in before I went to listen to election results. Hyde Park was a buzz. Of course, Hyde Park thinks of this election as its own, right? And the fact that the Obama kids were in school on Tuesday and Wednesday, and we all had to go ride around the TV cameras to get to our parking, was part of the kind of masochistic pleasure we're having in Hyde Park, which after all has always been told that it's the fringe of the nation. We've always been told that nothing we do or say there counts anywhere else, certainly not across the border in Indiana or the other border in America. So suddenly to find ourselves the center of the political process is kind of interesting. But this guy comes into my office and said to him, you know, where were you yesterday, on Wednesday? I said, where were you Tuesday? You went around. He said, I was in Grant Park. I said, you were in Grant Park? He said, yeah, I was right near the front. I could have touched Barack Obama. I said, how'd you get there? Tough to get tickets. He said, you don't understand. I said, a few years back, I worked law school. Yeah, I cleaned law school. Before we were casualized, I cleaned law school. And Obama's office was on my round. He said, I'm going. He worked late, many nights. And he was really interested. You know, I'd come by cleaning. He always stopped me for a chat. Sometimes he'd share his food with me. He always brought some food in for working late. And the thing was, he sat down. He talked to me. He said, tell me about your community. Tell me what's going on out there. I want to know. I want to know what's on the streets. I want to know how America is living. And one got the sense that this guy, alienated from the political process, alienated from the work process, found in Obama a real human being. Right? And these are the stories that congeal around charisma and that make him not merely a big man in history, but a big man become history. And I think that I always joke, as I joked with you a few moments ago, that yes, of course, it's very important that Obama is the first African-American president. I have 2 African-American grandchildren, and my grandson is a buzz. I mean, he can't get over it. You know, his new superhero is born on Krypton. We all know that Barack was born on Krypton, right? He told us that. But for this kid, he's going to come to adulthood with not merely an African-American president, but an intelligent president, somebody whom he can identify with because this man seems to be talking to and with America. Now, this is very idealistic, okay? And we're all going to be disappointed because in the final analysis, the politics of the modernist nation state puts enormous limits, even on the most enlightened democracy and Democrat. Although I do believe that it's very important at this moment in American politics to be strategically optimistic. I think strategic optimism really is a form of enablement because Obama's call, that speech in Grant Park was fascinating, Obama's call back to the people, back to a notion of the social. After all, we've been told since Reagan and Thatcher, there's no such thing as society. What counts is the market. What counts is greed. After all, Bush told us after Katrina that the way we'd solve the problem is to go shopping. My God. The notion of a return to a demos, to a people, was a very powerful call. After all, that speech re-evoked Martin Luther King. It invoked the New Deal. It invoked the demos. It really invoked the notion we, the people, have a stake. And, you know, he made a kind of pact with the American people. He said, look, my election is not the end of anything. It is the sort of dim beginning of a new understanding of what we have to make for America. And the idea of a project for America, of a collective making of the demos, is something I'm deeply hopeful that my grandchildren will grow up into, because anybody born or coming of age in the Thatcher Reagan years lost that sense entirely. I don't believe that we were a nation in any collective sense. We were a nation of individuals held together by a market. And that's a very different image of nationhood, and I hope it's one that we've passed by. But I was going to make a joke which is serious. And the joke that is serious is this. important, yes, it is, that Obama is an African American and that we can embrace difference, at least within the realm of thinkability. We haven't removed racism by any manner of means. I just hope to God that no crazy right-wing militia is planning assassinations, though I'm sure there are out there, and it scares me shitless. And I hope he survives, because this, we can't stand another Kennedy. Believe me, we did not recover from that assassination for a very long time. But more than that, Obama is the first president who is the son of an anthropologist. He's the son of an anthropologist. And anthropology is a discipline that lives by one principle. We study all kinds of different things. Once upon a time, we studied, quotes, primitive peoples. We don't do that any longer. We study everything. But anthropology as a discipline has as its mantra estrangement. Take nothing for granted. Whatever appear to you about the surfaces or in the surfaces of everyday life are not an answer to anything. They're a question about something. And I think that in a sense, Obama, although he's a legal scholar, is an organic anthropologist. He constantly asks the question, what lies behind the surfaces that we're seeing? And in a way, I think his background in constitutional law encourages him to do that. He was a wonderfully charismatic law teacher who was quite legendarily good at what he did. In fact, there were many efforts to persuade him to become a tenured professor at the University of Chicago. And I guess president kind of comes second after that.
Let me just say, this anthropology question fascinates me. An anthropologist in Montreal who listens to our program, Alexander Enkerly, wrote me this morning, and he said that the question for John Komaroff is, has anthropology won? And I've noticed anthropology kind of crowding my worldview and my interests lately, including the microhistorians. But this matter, among other things, as you say, of surfacing phantom histories, phantom people, untold narratives on the global periphery. There is some truth in your joke here. What is the secret?
Right. No, I mean, it is a very serious joke, because, you know, I think that one of the downsides of having been caught up in the neocon and the neoliberal moment was to set aside the question. We were persuaded that argument wasn't a real issue. We've seen a kind of almost the birth of a counter-enlightenment in the Bush years. Give me faith and I'll tell you the answer. Give me my heart and that's sufficient, a justification for the Iraq war or for judging good and evil, et cetera, et cetera. An anthropologist says, wait a moment, we have got to understand why one can run a nation on the basis of faith. That's not to decry faith, but it is to ask the question of what we sacrificed with reason and what we sacrificed with the forensics of human knowledge. The world that we're involved in has changed radically. We use terms like global, local, transnational, international, the electronic commons, these big terms, right? And we use them in almost an autonomic way, as though we all understand what they are. The anthropological quest is to say, wait a moment, we don't understand what they are. The world that we're living in is changing radically. My wife and I have written several times that we would make an argument for the fact that we're in an age of revolution, not unlike the age 1789 to 1848, the French Revolution, followed by revolutions in Europe that gave us democracy, that gave us the modernist nation state, that gave us concepts like culture, like society, like social class. Indeed, even the terms economy, mm-hmm. polity, those are all of that age.
So where did you locate the contemporary revolution?
The contemporary revolution, I think, comes to a head symbolically in exactly 200 years later, 1989. Now, all dates, like 1789 as well, are symbolic dates, because what happens is they congeal processes that have been, as it were, unfolding and come to a head, become visible, become noticeable. And they became noticeable to us at the end of the Cold War. Suddenly, we realized that changes in the nature of capitalism could bring down the Soviet Union. It wasn't Reagan who brought to the end of the Cold War. It was a particular moment in the history of capital in which fundamental changes in the relationship between work and labor, between production and geography. We entered a world in which geography suddenly changed. Once upon a time, we talked about the American working class. Suddenly, we discovered that Ford's workers were in Seoul and in Johannesburg and in Mexico City. So no longer could one think of the nation state as the crucible of economy, which meant that we had to understand the very nature. I had to give you an example. I had a great argument with the late James Coleman. James Coleman was a very fine sociologist, very different disposition to mine, but nonetheless a very fine sociologist who, in a public debate with me in Chicago, argued that America didn't have a working class. America was a middle-class society. And I turned to him and said, this is because you don't understand transnational geographies. Of course we have a working class, but it's elsewhere.
It's in China,
exactly. And because it's in China, we don't see it anymore. And because it's invisible, you stop taking it for and this is exactly what I mean by estrangement. Estrangement is asking the question of what it is we're not seeing about the nature of the world, so that when class becomes dispersed, we suddenly say, class is dead. Class isn't dead. It's just got a new geography. And so the notion of estranging the world, of digging at the surfaces, is the anthropological act. And I don't mean it in a narrow disciplinary sense. I mean it in the sense that everybody ought to be an anthropologist with a small a, because our civic duty, our duty as democratic citizens, is the duty of criticism. We ought always to be asking the question, why are these things as a, where are the inequities, where are the silences, where are the things we don't see? And the notion of an age of revolution, 1989 to, and of course we don't know when it's going to end, is basically about understanding how it is and why it is that jobs have changed their nature, that we've casualized labor entirely.
Casualized meaning deunionized it.
Exactly. Deunionizing labor, moving away
all
from
short-term, little commitment.
Exactly. So, for example, universities more and more are employing temporary and short-term professors and lecturers and goodness knows what else, preferring to stave off tenure as far as they can do it. And so people are deeply exploited. Obviously, under those conditions, find it very hard to do the kind of writing that would get you tenure anyway. And so the tendency for the lower end of market becomes great. And of course, it expresses itself in the national project as well. Look at the way in which we've privatized the means of force. Once upon a time, the state was the monopoly holder of the means of force. That was one of the definitions of the classical modernist capitalist nation state. The liberal democracy was that the state monopolized two things, the control over the flow of money and the control over the flow of legitimate violence. We now outsource both of those things. We outsource violence into the private sector. After all, much of the Iraq war is being fought by PMCs.
Yep.
Revolutions in Africa are fought by companies under contract. The Liberian Civil War was fought between two companies, basically. And who won? The side that could pay more in the end. Do we worry about this? Well, of course we should be worrying about it. Why? Because there is now a huge market interest in sustaining wars, in sustaining rendition, in sustaining forms of interrogation, which hopefully now are going to become illegal. But they may well not disappear. Certainly, once they're in the market, there are reasons to buy them. They elude the legal. We don't see them anymore because they're not part of the legal domain. Those kinds of shifts in the most policing is now done in the private sector across the world. Even in this country, almost 70% of all policing is the private sector. In South Africa, it's similar. What does that mean? It means that if a police, and I have a case in mind, if a policeman kills somebody who's a suspect, has happened in the streets of the place I live in South Africa, Sea Point. Does he come under state scrutiny as a policeman? No, he doesn't. This is a private felony. If it's a private felony, he's got to be prosecuted as though he were an ordinary murderer. That is very hard to do. There weren't witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. And so he gets away scot-free. He's not subject to losing his job. He's not subject to state review. He's not subject to any form of independent complaint mechanism. And this is exactly, of course, what has happened with much of the Iraq war and its weight. Many of the things that were really criminal can't be prosecuted by the process of the War Criminal Act because it belongs in that strange netherland of private violence, which we've after all employed people to conduct.
John Comer, this is completely fascinating, and I love your claim for the anthropologist and the son of an anthropologist. But let me make a slightly mischievous counterclaim for the novelists, too. I'm thinking very specifically of Zadie Smith's novel of roughly 8 years ago. It's been haunting me through the whole Bush period,
White Teeth.
And very broadly, it had so many things going on in it, but it was an argument about hybridization. She herself, a child of a white English father and a black Jamaican mother, but she drew that picture of Willesden in North London, and the playground in which Isaac Leung and Kwame O'Rourke, all these mixed children and names sort of bumping into each other, were playing and celebrating together. But the whole notion was she had this character writing a garden column in the newspaper. And it was all about hybridize your borders, dear, that, you know, the flowers will be brighter, the greens will last longer, et cetera, et cetera. And then comes 9/11, and we go into this, I called it sort of the white guys from Connecticut sort of putting up yellow lines around the world again and saying, brown and black, watch out. Right. You're fair targets, and we've got the guns. In the longer term, and I think even Zadie Smith said this to me in maybe 02 or 03, in the longer term, the tide seems so clearly to be going in the way of globalization, of hybridization of peoples, questions about nationalism and globalism. Take it at that axis of how the Obama moment challenges all of our thinking, past, present, and future, about human identity, the human family, the connections, the disconnections.
Right. That's a fascinating question. I think that you put your finger on an interesting paradox of the moment, which is dissolving itself into world history in interesting cases. I was a co-fellow with Zadie Smith at the Radcliffe Institute. I'm a great fan of her writing. And that picture of Willesden is actually the picture of my family. I have Jamaican-American grandchildren on one side, and a recently born granddaughter whose name is Mila B. Komaroff Wang Mi. Right, she's a Chinese American, South African, or whatever it is we are, and my African American, Jamaican American grandchildren are thrilled at the idea of having a Chinese cousin. We live basically in the deep end of the gene pool, and that I think is a wonderful end to be in. I think that in some ways the figure of Obama and his most famous speech, perhaps one of the most memorable speeches, well, for a very very long time, the kind of Gettysburg Address of Race, the one that came, as you recall, 6 months ago or so, which really changed the direction of the campaign in profound ways, was precisely about this, about his white grandmother, about the fears of race, about him representing a new moment in the re-racialization, de-racialization, in which difference can be subsumed into a form of worldliness and worldness that captures the future of the planet.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, yes, that is happening, and I think it's extremely exciting.
Speak about it even in your own terms, about the reconstruction or the deconstruction of this construct of race.
Well, this again, this is part of the paradox. On the one hand, it is being excessively complicated by the, if you like, the political sociology and the imagination of difference. We live in a world that is, you know, in which multiculturalism, which is a very complicated and compromised term, and often is a kind of liberal sop for recognitions that come without empowerment, come without resources, come without materiality. A kind of, it's a small world. Remember that Disney, it's a small world after all? It ain't a small world. The majority of kids who are living below a dollar a day are black and brown people. They're not white people from Connecticut. That's unlikely to change very much. So on the one hand, there is certainly a tendency toward the post-racialization of much of the world. That doesn't mean to say that there isn't a great deal of racism. After all, it is precisely in those moments of transition that various forms of hatred, of venality, come to the surface and express themselves because for many whites, not in America but across the world, the very threat of a growing hybridity is a threat of identity. It's a threat of a compromise to whiteness. And so, ironically, whiteness has become a problem in many parts. It has become a subject. After all, there are now more and more theses being written about whiteness. which was, of course, the unmarked term forever. We never think of white ethnic categories as ethnic. You know, Boston Brahmins are not the same as Indian Brahmins. Ethnicity means different things depending where in the social world one is placed. So, but on the one hand, the fact of greater degrees of post-racial identities are expressing themselves. At the same time, this marks a deeply contentious moment in world history in which the struggle over identity has become a struggle in many places to the death. Sometimes, of course, it's racialized very directly. Sometimes race is dispersed into ethnicity and becomes the object of ethnic struggles. And why race becomes ethnicity in so many contexts has to do with exactly the reason that blackness became African-Americanity in the U.S., which is to say blackness has always been imputed by dominant classes, i.e. those white guys from Connecticut, as an absence, as a negation. You are black because you lack something. You lack a nation, you lack an ethnicity, you're known purely by your body, purely by your biology. If you are African-American, you have culture. And that becomes a cultural claim and it becomes a positive claim, i.e. identity becomes the object of not negation, but positivity, of substance. And so when African-Americanity became a way of reinscribing blackness for people of color in America, and I think it's a crucial and crucially important moment, we suddenly get black history as a topic. Now it becomes African-American history. We get Black History Month. We get a Black American ritual calendar, Kwanzaa. Those things are important. I mean, when they first happened, people joked about them very much as they joked about feminism when women wanted recognition for forms of female revaluation of language. Those things are often treated as trivial by those to whom it doesn't count. They are extremely important to those who do. And so African-Americanity, the rewriting of race into culture, became a very important moment. But at the same time, there are pressures that reinscribe race in America, race across the world. One of them is the increasing geneticization of human identity. We're moving back into sideways, into a period in which identity is becoming ever more biologized and geneticized. And that has its dangers too. After all, that's what the Holocaust was about. It was about the geneticization of Jews against an Aryan specter, or at least the other way around. So geneticization is also hovering in the background of identity. We're going through, again, a revisioning of identity in ways that bring into profound... the entire world is going through a resurgence of identity politics in which identity has been claimed both in the name of culture and in the name of genetics, which, of course, we've always seen in the West as contradictory. Either you choose something or you are something. More and more we're seeing identity as both of those things at once. So how do I know that I'm a Navajo? I have Navajo blood and I choose to be a Navajo. Both of those things at once. How do I know that I'm Jewish? I have a Jewish gene and this is now a big trade in Jewish genetics and I choose to be Jewish. And there are ways so these things are also recreating new kinds of boundary, which is exactly why I say we are in an anthropological moment. We're trying to understand what is going on with identity, why it's suddenly become important.
Exactly. But how does Barack Obama, who's Kenyan and Kansan and chose to be black, but also believes in talking to people, mm-hmm. adversaries or not, mm-hmm. How does he nudge this whole question?
Well, I think that you know, there are two views. One is the apartheid view, and the other is the post-apartheid view. The post-apartheid view goes back, ironically, to American roots. It says we're a nation of difference. We're a nation whose strength is predicated on difference. After all, Bonnie Honig's book on the role of the stranger in America, and how we have really created value out of a nation created on polysemy, on plurality, which, of course, in the Reagan and post-Reagan years, became the object of a kind of boomerang effect. What counted was our nationness. We were really one nation, and difference had to be submerged. Private sector, yeah, you could, you know, believe in Orisha, in the privacy of your own home, but dare not bring it into public domain. You can be anything you like in the privacy of your own home, provided you don't break the law, but don't bring it into the public sphere. That, after all, is part of, it's an extension of our notion of the separation of church and state, taken to to its furthest ends. But the point here was that in effect, Americanness over the last couple of decades has become white maleness all over again. And that's what the conservative moment was. It really, the family values was about reconciling women into positions of subordination in domesticity. The notion of the absence of plurality, you know, and to me, what the Obama moment celebrates is a re-envisioning of America as a sum of difference, not an extrusion of singularity. And frankly, the ways in which we reacted to Islam and made it into an evil empire, thereby devaluing one of the great world religions and making it into an object of terrorism and talking about crusades and a kind of theology, was an American nightmare. We did become rogue in the eyes of the world, because the world knows that it isn't that way. Right? We're the only people who are actually asked to believe that garbage. Yeah. After all, you know, we're talking about a huge proportion of world cultures, which we made into a horrible caricature, and you know, no attention to the fact that a significant proportion of our population are Muslim. Look at what happened to Rashid Khalidi. Okay, who's been called everything.
Ugliest moments.
It was extremely ugly.
John McCain said, well, if I were caught with neo-Nazis, somebody would call me at it. Well, hello, Rashid is not...
Rashid Khalidi is a friend of mine. He's part of the, and I'm very proud to call him a friend of mine. He's one of the great scholars of Middle Eastern history. He's written two or three of the best books on the modern Middle East, and there's no question about that. After all, when he was snapped up by Columbia away from Chicago, we mourned his loss as a scholar. He was an extraordinary teacher. He was also, of course, a common guest on Ted Koppel's Nightline. Why? Because as a Jewish Zionist friend once said to me, he was a Palestinian you could take home to mother. An extraordinarily reasonable, deeply liberal, secular Muslim.
A Yale,
and by no manner of means a Palestinian leader. Yes, he was part of the negotiations of peace in the Middle East, and thank God he was, because he was a greater voice of reason than some of the voices of extremism on both the Zionist and the Palestinian side.
And an heir to a family tradition that goes back 1,000 years. In
the Khalidis are the Kennedys of Jerusalem. This is a dynasty of political reason. It would be like calling the Kennedys a bunch of crazy Irish Catholics, which would be absurd. To those of us who know Rashid, this was one of the most bizarre moments. But it's clear, of course, like in many other things, what we lost in the Bush years was truth. After all, this was a president who could lie to the nation with no consequence and could be re-elected having done it. 30 years ago, that would have called for a resignation, a vote of no confidence. Think of the Macmillan years in Britain. Who could have lied like that? After all, John Profumo once lied about a prostitute and he had to resign. There was once, the notion of non-immunity, non-impunity in dealing with public. But during the Bush years, we got lying as a national practice. I'm sure that neither John McCain nor Sarah Palin have any idea who Rashid Khalidi is. I'm sure, aides talked about him being some kind of crazy Palestinian. Did they ever read a word he wrote? Did they know that he was an author of serious magnitude, or one of America's great historians? Right? We're talking about a great historian here. We're talking about somebody who, after all, changed the basis of our knowledge of the Middle East to be made into, this is caricature of the... But nobody called. There seemed to be no impulsion or compulsion in the political process to the truth. Now, if that's what we lost during the... Then thank God we have a new moment when truth, one hopes, becomes a condition of democracy.
This leads to another thing I was dying to ask you, which has to do with the Obama moment and journalism, news, conversation, the public intellectual realm, media in general, and how it has been driven to an extreme, perhaps, by exactly the kind of casual, well, it's not true, but you can't check it, or it's not true, but I don't care, it's not true, but too late, et cetera. What does the Obama moment mean about public conversation? And we got to throw in the internet, which we couldn't spell in 1989, which you consider the start of the revolution, but we are in a new place about the world talking to itself, right. What it talks about, how it talks about, who gets to talk. What do we expect from this moment?
Well, I think we expect two things. One is the obligation to listen.
There's
the listening part. Talking is one thing, listening is another. My compatriots in South Africa always say that democracy only begins when people listen, not when people talk. And my late colleague, I think I mentioned this to you, Wayne Booth, was fond of saying that freedom of speech is guaranteed in America only as long as nobody's listening. I think that if this new moment, this moment of strategic optimism, as I said earlier, who knows, but let's hope this is a moment of hope. Barack Obama uses the audacity of hope. Well, I have an audacity to hope that a return to democracy, insofar as it is going to happen, is going to be about the necessity of hearing. But that also throws, I think, an extraordinary obligation, a moral obligation, an ethical obligation on journalism. I think the press let us down very badly over the Iraq War. It gave a free ride to a president who didn't deserve a free ride, even when there were plenty of critics making very strong arguments, right. Well-backed up arguments about the falsity of the claims. The press, they were cowed. They were self-censoring. And in a democracy, nobody self-censors. And that's what one hopes is what will define the moment. But I tell you something more important about this. I have an enormous respect for forensic journalism. I think forensic journalism is basically anthropology for the public. And what I mean by it is this. The kind of journalism that precisely takes as its obligation the probing of surfaces. Why are we hearing what we're hearing? Why are we being told what we're being told? Who is asking the questions on our behalf? And I think that in that sense, journalism is the first estate, not the third or the fifth or whatever. It's the first estate. It's the estate of truth. It can only be the estate of truth to the degree that it represents its population. We know nowadays that after all, politicians don't. Politicians represent capital. They represent the access to wealth. They represent the capacity to turn financial assets into votes in Congress. They don't necessarily, once they voted, represent us. They may or they may not. Some do, some don't. That's a question of good as opposed to bad representation. But the press is always there and always ought to be represented.
Stick with this definition of forensic journalism. What do you mean by that? Would Rupert Murdoch claim that he's practicing forensic journalism at Fox News?
I'm sure he would, but it would not be hard to indicate that much of Fox News really is the enunciation of a political voice. I've actually never heard news on Fox. I've heard commentaries on the news. I've heard claims for the news. I've heard representations of partial realities. But as John Stewart once said of The Daily Show, we're in the tragic situation where most of us actually get our news from Comedy Central. We certainly don't get it from Fox.
Is John Stewart practicing forensic journalism? What is it? And who are the practitioners?
Okay, look, I think that some comedy is forensic journalism, but I was using that more as joke than anything else. Actually, I think that John Stewart and Colbert really did do a service during the Bush administration.
No,
I think they were really very serious people, precisely by pointing out the contradictions, the stupidities of administration speak and of regime speak. So in a way, they obviously weren't producing the news, but they were producing a kind of forensic discomfort with the news that made one think about it. They, as it were, served notice to what it was we were not seeing by virtue of it being half hidden by the likes of Fox and the likes of the liberal press as well, which didn't do much better.
Right.
A return to forensic journalism is about news analysis. It is about the relationship between the production of fact and its interrogation. After all, the fact doesn't float free in space. The fact is as much a manufacture as anything else. And understanding the process of its manufacture, asking how we are being fed the kinds of representation. And, I think Obama is going to have to be held to account every much as bit as Bush is, or Mandela was, or anybody else is. The fact that matter is, we live in a world totally of spin.
John Comer, remind me what forensic journalism sounds like, looks like. Who are those careful, wares and the kind of fearlessly
independent. I think Paul Krugman at his best is a really good economic. Now, there are two Paul Krugmans. There's the Paul Krugman who does high-end, quite complex technical economics. There's a Paul Krugman who also poses really difficult questions about the nature of the economy. There's also the Paul Krugman who is a political protagonist, and that's okay, but at least we know which of the three he's being when he writes.
And we won't force the Nobel Committee to tell us which one they gave the prize to. I think it was to the Public Advocate, but
I think it may be true, but on the other hand, they gave it to how many disciples of Milton Friedman, who after all have been public advocates of the Chilean administration, structural adjustment, the loss of how many jobs across the global South. Are those not protagonists? We're having this argument right now about the Milton Friedman Institute at Chicago, and the same point has been made about they do very serious economics, technical economics, like I do technical anthropology, and they do advocacy, and they sometimes those lines are deeply obscured, and a forensic journalism tells us when that is, when a Gary Becker is telling us about the technicalities of the operations of a market, and when he's essaying free markets,
Come back to the models we've got to rebuild or rediscover of journalism for this moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'd like to answer. May I answer the question in relation to what I know best, which is South Africa?
Sure.
Because that's a very interesting place in which there's been a strong commitment to a critical press and a public domain of argumentation. One thing I should say, I would love to see, but I know I'm never going to see, is the emergence of a Habermasian public sphere in America, where there is real argument, where the right doesn't talk to the right and the liberal center left doesn't talk to the liberal center left, where nobody writes to the right of it. Till of the Hun would read the New York Times, and nobody to the left of I don't know, is Obama a socialist? would listen to right wing talk radio. We don't talk to each other, so we don't argue. We simply reiterate our positions. And in a way, in South Africa, there's been a deep commitment to not allowing that to happen, to having a national argument. And what forensic journalists do constantly is hold government to account for what it's doing. It poses, so for example, the argument about crime. Let me take that. It's a very interesting one. Here we have, we treat crime as though it was simply a social fact. There are criminals out there. There is no conversation about the relationship between crime and economy, crime and politics, crime and race of any serious proportion. In fact, you can't get a serious conversation about crime and race anymore. Why is this incredible proportion of black youth incarcerated? Why is this incredible proportion of black youth never anything more than disposable and warehoused and part of the non-citizens of America? That's a human tragedy of incredible proportions, and it is a form of if you like, ethnicity. Side. We sort of consign an enormous proportion of America into nowhereness. It's very hard to get a serious conversation about that. South Africa has a very interesting journalist, a man called Johnny Steinberg. He's actually working in New York City now and doing a very interesting project there. He's written a series. He first wrote a series of columns for Business Day, a very reputable South African newspaper, and then a series of books on crime in South Africa. This is a guy, a Rhodes Scholar, PhD in political theory, who decided he didn't want to become just another scholar. Forensic journalism was how he would engage as a public intellectual in South Africa. So the role of the public intellectual, which we've instilled almost entirely in the liberal center, except as noisemakers, is something that also needs to return, I think. But what Steinberg does is say to South Africa, crime is about political economy. It's not about people making bad decisions. It's about joblessness. It is about domestic violence. It's about the absence of antiretrovirals for AIDS sufferers, which produces extraordinary domestic violence. It is about all kinds of things. Let us interrogate what it's about. The surfaces aren't good enough. The surfaces are, we've got a lot of crime, and we should all panic, and we should all be afraid. But leave time amidst your fear for the question of why it is. Because next time you read a figure which says the unemployment rate has gone up by 5%, that's when you should be worrying about crime. Not because you see scary black people on the street, which is, of course, the way we racialize it. What we do is we make crime basically a problem of identity, not a problem of politics, not a problem of economics. And we've been allowed to get away with that here. That's what a forensic journalism does. It asks those kinds of questions. It asks why it is that we allowed the Patriot Act to persist long beyond its reasonable use in this country, basically making us subject of a very intrusive state that really did erode our freedoms in fundamental ways. And what did we do about it? Mm. Which one of us got up and screamed and shouted? I know that when I did in the classroom, I was on a website within 15 minutes saying that, you know, I was a threat to America, okay? And who answered that? Who said, no, this is actually democratic free speech?
It's interesting, and it's different from investigative journalism. It sounds to me like what Charlie Savage did, though, on the signing statements.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's a good example.
Charlie Savage, first of the Boston Globe, now the New York Times. I mean, that was exemplary. Here's a mischievous question. Has Google killed journalism? That you can look up anything and get the little answer so fast?
I think it's a threat to journalism, and I think it poses the threat of trivialization, which is to say we live in an oversupply of information and an undersupply of facts and analysis. You can find anything in Google, but...
Who's going to rebuild those institutions of independent analysis, perspective, commentary?
Well, I really think that this is a wonderful call to the universities to reassert their relevance. What we've seen again is the trivialization of the university as an institution.
Yeah.
We've seen, Sarah Palin was talking about just cutting funding for all kinds of research without any idea of what that research was about. This was going to be the panacea for our problems, that we can spend more money in Iraq.
Alaska too, yeah.
Alaska, oh yes, that's right. We need bridges, right? We do need bridges. We need bridges into the inner recesses of knowledge. We need bridges into the re-education of America, which has become de-schooled in fundamental sorts of ways over since the 1980s, I think. And I think that the universities owe an obligation not simply to policy. I think that's a cheap way of thinking about the application of knowledge, but again, to critical analysis. If you think about, for example, public culture in Germany or in South Africa or in some of the more enlightened nation states of the world where this is taken to be a public obligation, the levels of public discourse are so much higher. The notions of really trying to understand what is going on in the world is so much higher. The conversations that as an intellectual I cannot have outside of my small collegium in America, which are perfectly comfortable in Berlin and perfectly comfortable in Barcelona and perfectly comfortable in Johannesburg, but make no sense here. The vast majority of Americans have no idea what anthropology or sociology or even economics really is. We know what business schools are. That's different. And in that sense, we've lost any purchase with enlightenment, with the notion that understanding the world makes it a better place. That's why, I mean, that's one of my bits of on strategic optimism about Obama. He is a truly intelligent, inquiring mind. And if that brings with it a revaluation of education because there is enormous human capital in it, enormous cultural capital, and after all, the American empire is threatened. We're threatened by the economies of China and Russia. We're threatened by the resurgence of the Middle East and in part Europe. The comfortable notion that the American economy will triumph in the end is, believe me, deeply under threat. How are we going to restore it? We're going to restore it not by simply investing more money in the stock market, but investing more money in human beings, because that's how value gets produced.
Yeah. And we might even have a critical conversation about this word empire, which is not allowed to enter the American conversation at the New York Times level or even at the presidential campaign level.
Of course it's not allowed to because we don't understand the difference between empire and imperialism. Strictly speaking, in many places, we're not an empire, but we are deeply imperialistic.
We are dominators. We are bullies. We have been in the humiliation game up to our necks in recent years. Mm-hmm.
Yep, we certainly have. And the costs, again, were to render us pariah. If we are to re-enter the world as a positive force, a force which doesn't presume that we can civilize others, but we can learn from the civilizations of others, if we realize that the global moment is an opportunity to really learn, to understand that there are many other points on the planet that are far in advance of us in understanding the effects of the history of capitalism that we're living through, mm-hmm. the history of democracy that we're living through, the threats to world order, the identity politics that are surfacing. The moment that we begin to take those seriously is the moment we re-enter the globe as equal partners, neither as dominators nor as pariahs. Domination and pariah status kill nation states. They don't make them.
I have to ask you, though, what if, as Orlando Patterson writes in the New York Times today, we have just come through the most sublime event in the history of democracy in all the 25 centuries since Greece invented the word?
Congratulations, Orlando, for a measured understatement. what can I say? As an historical anthropologist, I know very well that there are political reasons for reading history in positive light and good intellectual reasons for holding one's judgment. I don't know whether it was the most important. He uses the word sublime, and sublime is a very complex concept.
A sublime word, yes.
Right. It's a very ambiguous word too,
right.
And in its old classical sense of being both a moment of wonderment, a thing of wonderment, but also a thing of fear, a thing of the unknowability, then maybe it is, if not the most sublime moment, it is certainly a sublime moment. Who knows what the sublime was? Was the sublime in this respect the end of the Cold War? That, after all, did liberate a lot of people from a lot of things, but it created other kinds of problems. We don't know what the implications of last Tuesday are. That's why I talk about strategic optimism.
I was going to say, the phrases that I take away are strategic optimism, thank you, Orlando, but also critical estrangement.
Absolutely. Both of those things are, and again, I think one hopes a return to politics in a new moment of regeneration in both of those senses of the term, in which all of us as Americans, and now the world can be, you know, ich bin Amerikaner, right? At last, maybe, I felt really proud about being an American last Wednesday. I haven't felt that for 8 years. And, you know, I'm a displaced citizen. I want to claim Americanity, but I want to claim Americanity as a form of world citizenship, not as a form of exclusion. And if this moment brings us a moment of regeneration, of a disalienation from the political, of a re-engagement of a nation in a public discourse, it's going to be divided discourse. The right is still there and the left is still there. And we still see fundamentally different things when we look out at the world. But at least if we can argue about them, at least if we can argue about them not in a spirit of counter-enlightenment, but of a spirit of critical estrangement, then maybe there is a future for American democracy. Then maybe we can reclaim a notion of an American century, provided it's a century we share with the rest of the world and not take from it.
I think Barack Obama understands it, and he said it in that marvelous compact little greeting to Berlin.
Yeah.
During the campaign, he said, "I'm a proud citizen of the United States, fellow citizen of the world."
Right.
And he got away with it.
Oh, and I think he deserved to get away with it because he went on to prove worthy of the claim.
Amen. John Comeroff, such a pleasure to meet you and to feel a real kinship here. We must continue this conversation, but it's been a whole lot of fun.
Only with pleasure. Come and visit us in Hyde Park. It is, for at least the moment, the center of the world.
Thank you, John.
Philip Guerra and Sarah Archambault produced this conversation with John Comeroff. Sarah Archambault edited it. Thanks also to our intern, Hannah Olson. Everybody's struggling to see dimensions of this Obama moment in the global conversation. Post yours in a comment, please, at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining the conversation. Mm-hmm.